Chapter 25. Retrospective, Joan DaCosta had relied entirely on Judge Albero, and his death was most unfortunate. Before he was judge at Manaus, and chief magistrate in the province, Ribeiro had known the young clerk at the time he was being prosecuted for the murder in the Diamond Aerial. He was then an advocate at Villa Rica, and he it was who defended the prisoner at the trial. He took the cause to heart, and made it his own, and from an examination of the papers and detailed information, and not from the simple fact of his position in the matter, he came to the conclusion that his client was wrongfully accused, and that he had taken not the slightest part in the murder of the escort, or the theft of the diamonds. In a word, that Joan DaCosta was innocent. But, notwithstanding this conviction, notwithstanding his talent and zeal, Ribeiro was unable to persuade the jury to take the same view of the matter. How could he remove so strong a presumption? If it was not Joan DaCosta, who had every facility for informing the scoundrels of the convoy's departure, who was it? The official who accompanied the escort had perished with the greater part of the soldiers, and suspicion could not point against him. Everything agreed in distinguishing DaCosta as the true and only author of the crime. Ribeiro defended him with great warmth and with all his powers, but he could not succeed in saving him. The verdict of the jury was affirmative on all the questions. Joan DaCosta, convicted of aggravated and premeditated murder, did not even obtain the benefit of extenuating circumstances, and heard himself condemned to death. There was no hope left for the accused. No commutation of the sentence was possible, for the crime was committed in the Diamond Aerial. The condemned man was lost. But during the night which preceded his execution, and when the gallows was already erected, Joan DaCosta managed to escape from the prison at Villa Rica. We know the rest. 20 years later, Ribeiro the advocate became the Chief Justice of Manaus. In the depths of his retreat, the fazender of Iquitos heard of the change, and in it saw a favorable opportunity for bringing forward the revision of the former proceedings against him with some chance of success. He knew that the old convictions of the advocate would be still unshaken in the mind of the judge. He therefore resolved to try and rehabilitate himself. Had it not been for Ribeiro's nomination to the chief justiceship in the province of Amazons, he might perhaps have hesitated, for he had no new material proof of his innocence to bring forward. Although the honest man suffered acutely, he might still have remained hidden in exile at Iquitos, and still have asked for time to smother the remembrances of the horrible occurrence, but something was urging him to act in the matter without delay. In fact, before Iquita had spoken to him, Joan DaCosta had noticed that Manuel was in love with his daughter. The union of the young army doctor and his daughter was in every respect a suitable one. It was evident to Joan that someday or other he would be asked for her hand in marriage, and he did not wish to be obliged to refuse. But then the thought that his daughter would have to marry under a name which did not belong to her, that Manuel Valdez, thinking he was entering the family of Garl, would enter that of DaCosta, the head of which was under sentence of death, was intolerable to him. No. The wedding should not take place, unless under proper conditions. Never. Let us recall what had happened up to this time. 4 years after the young clerk, who eventually became the partner of Magalhaes, had arrived at Iquitos, the old Portuguese had been taken back to the farm mortally injured. A few days only were left for him to live. He was alarmed at the thought that his daughter would be left alone and unprotected. But knowing that Joan and Iquita were in love with each other, he desired their union without delay. Joan at first refused. He offered to remain the protector, or the servant of Iquita without becoming her husband. The wish of the dying Magalhaes was so urgent that resistance became impossible. Iquita put her hand into the hand of Joan, and Joan did not withdraw it. Yes. It was a serious matter. Joan DaCosta ought to have confessed all, or to have fled forever from the house in which he had been so hospitably received, from the establishment of which he had built up the prosperity. Yes. To confess everything, rather than to give to the daughter of his benefactor a name which was not his, instead of the name of a felon condemned to death for murder, innocent though he might be. But the case was pressing, the old Fazender was on the point of death, his hands were stretched out toward the young people. Joam was silent, the marriage took place, and the remainder of his life was devoted to the happiness of the girl he had made his wife. The day when I confess everything, Joam repeated, Yaquita will pardon everything. She will not doubt me for an instant. But if I ought not to have deceived her, I certainly will not deceive the honest fellow who wishes to enter our family by marrying Mina. No. I would rather give myself up, and have done with this life. Many times had Joam thought of telling his wife about his past life. Yes, the avowal was on his lips, whenever she asked him to take her into Brazil, and with her and her daughter descend the beautiful Amazon River. He knew sufficient of Yaquita to be sure that her affection for him would not thereby be diminished in the least. But courage failed him. And this is easily intelligible in the face of the happiness of the family, which increased on every side. This happiness was his work, and it might be destroyed forever by his return. Such had been his life for those long years, such had been the continuous source of his sufferings, of which he had kept the secret so well, such had been the existence of this man, who had no action to be ashamed of, and whom a great injustice compelled to hide away from himself. But at length the day arrived, when there could no longer remain a doubt as to the affection which Manuel bore to Minha, when he could see that a year would not go by before he was asked to give his consent to her marriage, and after a short delay he no longer hesitated to proceed in the matter. A letter from him, addressed to Judge Ribeiro, acquainted the Chief Justice with the secret of the existence of Joam da Costa, with the name under which he was concealed, with the place where he lived with his family, and at the same time with his formal intention of delivering himself up to justice, and taking steps to procure the revision of the proceedings, which would either result in his rehabilitation, or in the execution of the iniquitous judgment delivered at Villa Rica. What were the feelings which agitated the heart of the worthy magistrate? We can easily divine them. It was no longer to the advocate that the accused applied. It was to the Chief Justice of the province that the convict appealed. Joam da Costa gave himself over to him entirely, and did not even ask him to keep the secret. Judge Ribeiro was at first troubled about this unexpected revelation, but he soon recovered himself, and scrupulously considered the duties which the position imposed on him. It was his place to pursue criminals, and here was one who delivered himself into his hands. This criminal, it was true, he had defended. He had never doubted but that he had been unjustly condemned. His joy had been extreme when he saw him escape by flight from the last penalty. He had even instigated and facilitated his flight. But what the advocate had done in the past could the magistrate do in the present? Well, yes, had the judge said, my conscience tells me not to abandon this just man. The step he is taking is a fresh proof of his innocence, a moral proof, even if he brings me others, which may be the most convincing of all. No, I will not abandon him. From this day forward a secret correspondence took place between the magistrate and Joam da Costa. Ribeiro at the outset cautioned his client against compromising himself by any imprudence. He had again to work up the matter, again to read over the papers, again to look through the inquiries. He had to find out if any new facts had come to light in the Diamond Province referring to so serious a case. Had any of the accomplices of the crime, of the smugglers who had attacked the convoy, been arrested since the attempt? Had any confessions or half-confessions been brought forward? Joam da Costa had done nothing but protest his innocence from the very first. But that was not enough, and Judge Ribeiro was desirous of finding in the case itself the clue to the real culprit. Joam da Costa had accordingly been prudent. He had promised to be so. But in all his trials it was an immense consolation for him to find his old advocate, though now a chief justice, so firmly convinced that he was not guilty. Yes. Joam da Costa, in spite of his condemnation, was a victim, a martyr, an honest man to whom society owed a signal reparation. And when the magistrate knew the past career of the Fazender of Iquitos since his sentence, the position of his family, all that life of devotion, of work, employed unceasingly for the happiness of those belonging to him, he was not only more convinced but more affected, and determined to do all that he could to procure the rehabilitation of the felon of Tijuco. For 6 months a correspondence had passed between these two men. One day, the case being pressing, Joam da Costa wrote to Judge Ribeiro, "In 2 months I will be with you, in the power of the Chief Justice of the province." "Come, then," replied Ribeiro. The jangada was then ready to go down the river. Joam da Costa embarked on it with all his people. During the voyage, to the great astonishment of his wife and son, he landed but rarely, as we know. More often he remained shut up on his room, writing, working, not at his trading accounts, but, without saying anything about it, at a kind of memoir, which he called The History of My Life, and which was meant to be used in the revision of the legal proceedings. 8 days before his new arrest, made on account of information given by Torres, which forestalled and perhaps would ruin his prospects, he entrusted to an Indian on the Amazon a letter, in which he warned Judge Ribeiro of his approaching arrival. The letter was sent and delivered as addressed, and the magistrate only waited for Joam da Costa to commence on the serious undertaking which he hoped to bring to a successful issue. During the night before the arrival of the raft at Manaus, Judge Ribeiro was seized with an attack of apoplexy. But the denunciation of Torres, whose scheme of extortion had collapsed in face of the noble anger of his victim, had produced its effect. Joam da Costa was arrested in the bosom of his family, and his old advocate was no longer in this world to defend him. Yes, the blow was terrible indeed. His lot was cast, whatever his fate might be, there was no going back for him. And Joam da Costa rose from beneath the blow which had so unexpectedly struck him. It was not only his own honor which was in question, but the honor of all who belonged to him. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.